Go to the table to look at.
Yeah.
Because we could do a meeting for that.
There are any technical issues. I don't know. That's out of our control.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Katoa. Welcome everyone. Just before we take appearances, I'd like to welcome His Honour Judge Williams, Judge of the Murray-Dane Court and Ultimate Environment Judge, to our bench for this hearing. Welcome, Your Honour.
Thank you, Chief Judge, for your greeting, and hopefully I can be of some assistance in this proceeding, so thank you.
Sure, surely will. Now, appearances. Mr. Conrad.
Inga kaifakua, tēnā korua. Inga kumihana, tēnā korua. Ko Matt Conway toku ingoa. Kei konei mātou. Ko Tim Fisher, ko Lydia Chai, mō te Waikato Regional Council.
Thank you very much. The Director General's Council. Kōrena.
Kōrena, koutou. May it please the Court, Council's name's Ms. Tumai, and I'm here with Ms. Cooper. We are here for the Director General of Conservation.
May it please the Court, Council's name is Ms. Onley, and I appear for the Auckland Waikato Fish and Game Council. I'm entering appearance for Mr. Williamson for Royal Forest and Bird, and Mr. Williamson reserves the ability, if you like, to present some submissions further in the hearing, because Your Honour's granted come and go leave.
Yes, I was going to address that generally in a moment, but we can cover that off.
Thank you.
But thank you. So you're keeping an eye on things on behalf of Mr. Williamson.
That's right, sir.
Very good.
Mr. Anderson.
Anderson, sorry. Not sure where I got that name from, but there we are.
Morena, may it please the Court. Council's name is Min Hinnick. I appear with Ms. Gilbert for Fonterra and Dairy NZ.
Thank you, Mr. Minhart.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. Council's name is Matheson, appearing with Ms. Edwards for Federated Farmers.
Thank you, Mr. Matheson. Ms. Edwards.
May it please the Court. My name is Thompson, and I appear with Ms. Lucetti, Lusetti. Will be for Land New Zealand. Sir, to avoid any doubt, we are presenting a joint case with Federated Farmers, but I can address those matters in a more appropriate time.
Thanks. Thank you for that indication. Mr. Majuri, We're going across this way. I might have zigzagged, but I thought, no, there's Mr. Majuri. I'll call on him.
So that reassessed. Then I get to get the Majuri for you to get home.
Thank you very much.
Tēnā kai pakawā, tēnā kōrua, e ngā kai komihana, tēnā kōrua. Ko Jamie Ferguson taku inoa, e mangai tūri mō ngā iwi, o ngā awa o Waikato, me Waipa, Waikato Raupatu River Trust, Raukawa Charitable Trust, Te Aroa River Iwi Trust, Tūwhare Toa Māori Trust Board, and Maniapoto Māori Trust Board, which is no longer. So it's now Tenehi Nehi Nui, and I will file a memorandum confirming the name change there following the recent settlement. Also appear for CMI, Iwi Land Management Limited. Kia ora.
Thank you, Mr. Ferguson.
May it please the court, Ms. Chappell, initials GK for OG Fiber Solutions, New Zealand Limited.
Thank you, Ms. Chappell.
May it please the court, Mia Tog and Ford for Horticulture New Zealand. Thanks, sir.
Any other counsel appearing? Ms. Forrett.
Please, the court. Counsel's name is Ms. Forrett. I have with me Ms. Mugridge appearing for Lockheel Farmlands Limited.
Thank you. Anyone else present on the court? And then online, Ms. Carruthers.
Yes, good morning.
I called on you first, shouldn't I?
No, that's absolutely fine. I'm planning on coming in after everybody else from Canterbury, but thank you, sir. I'm here for Wairaku Pastoral.
Thank you. And who else have we got there online? Sorry, I'm not sure.
Sir, I may just intercept. We seem to be having some audio issues online this morning, so I'm not sure if other counsel that I can see on my box, if they can actually hear you as yet or are able to speak.
Now, we do seem to have some difficulties there. Counsel who are online, if you can indicate you can hear me, perhaps raise a hand. Yes, you can hear me. We can't hear you. But it may be that we can work on that if you'd like to stay on and listen. If anything emerges which is of significance, I suggest you email the registrar. That's Ms. Kim, and we'll follow that up as best we can. Now, we've got a screen which has been going on and off, and so I can't even see a signal from those people. No. And then on the other side, is that Mr. Pennell?
Yes, it is.
All right. Well, we can hear you, Mr. Pennell. Thank you. You can hear us, obviously.
Yes, I can, sir.
Very good. Now, is there anyone else who's on screen who can hear us and can speak, and hopefully we can hear them? No. All right. Well, we'll keep working on the technical aspects. We've got a bit of time in front of us, and I just need to make sure that we don't miss anyone out as we go through. Is there any other person, not Counsel or otherwise online, who's entering appearance today? No. Very good. There's a few things that I would like just to address in a general way about our procedure. So that, and these are things which we'll probably have to keep track of as we go. We're scheduled to sit for these appeals on Plan Change 1 to the Waikato Regional Plan for 6 weeks, but we have a timetable that indicates we may well be able to finish the hearing within 4 weeks. How optimistic that is probably depends on the parties themselves. It is of enormous importance that we not go beyond the 6 weeks that we have available, and so we will be keeping a close eye on timing as we go. And what I'd like to be able to do is to have the registrar send a global email to everyone who's on our address list at the end of each day to say where we are at, and and I'll be looking to Council, and in particular Mr. Cromwell and Mr. Fisher, for ongoing advice about whether or not we're on track with our timing. And in particular, if we seem to be falling behind, I'd be grateful for warnings about that so we can see what we can do in the meantime. But as I say, it does look as though we should have ample time available for people to say what they want to say in the course of this hearing. And now I'd just like to talk a little bit about what people may want to say and what we may want to hear. Before I do that, I should say that, yes, leave to come and go, the famous John Burns order, has been made for everyone to participate. And so you are not required to be here throughout. You're welcome to attend at those times when you think you need to be here, either to present your case or to cross-examine witnesses being called by others. You're on your own lookout in relation to that. As I say, the registrar will provide a daily update as to how far we've got, and you're welcome to talk amongst yourselves about where things are at, and as has happened with Mr. Anderson, to maybe say to somebody who may be here throughout or for longer periods to keep an eye on things on your behalf. But I'm not going to be in a position, and the registrar is not going to be in a position to chase everyone up individually in terms of what's happening as we go. We are going to proceed party by party. At one stage, we toyed with the idea of trying to proceed issue by issue, and we gave up on that at a fairly early stage because it appeared to be too complicated. There is one exception for that, and that is for the point source discharges. And I note that, for example, Mr. Muldowney is not here, although Ms. Chappell is here for one of the point source discharge parties. We are expecting to address the point source discharge issues in the week following Labor Day, that's on 24, 25, possibly 26 October. Now, as has been raised by Ms. Chappell on behalf of OG, there are a number of witnesses, and possibly there are parties who are going to be addressing some point source issues in the course of their case during the primary hearing. But what we will be expecting is that any party or witness who is addressing a particular issue in relation to point source discharges will be present and presenting on 24, 25 and possibly 26 October, so that we have a focused hearing in relation to the point source discharges. We're not going to cut across anyone who may raise something because of the fact that some of the issues affect both point source and diffuse discharges. So we're not going to try and be too firm about that. But if you are going to say anything, or if a witness is going to say anything which is particularly relevant to the point source discharge provisions, then you may need to come back on 24, 25, 26 October. Is that clear? Thank you. We have received the legal submissions in writing on behalf of the Regional Council and also on behalf of the Director General of Conservation. We've had a look at that, at those. It does appear to us that, and there's several things I need to say about this, that the scale of Plan Change 1 is such that obviously everyone is focused on the things that are of the main concern to them. We're just getting to grips with what the central or perhaps priority issues may be in relation to this, as distinct from some of the more detailed matters. We will need your assistance as we do that, and it will be quite important for you to be able to say which are the issues which you think are of broad or even global concern in relation to Plan Change 1, and which are the issues which you, as you are entitled to do, are pursuing for your client and their particular interests in this. Really what I'm saying is please help us to get an understanding of how you see the issues on the Plan Change. There are a number of questions that then arise out of the issues, and we know that there are a number of matters of jurisdiction that have yet to be resolved. We've made a decision not to try to sort out some of those jurisdictional things ahead of time because it appears appeared to us that that might be putting the cart before the horse. But we still need to bear them in mind. Overseer is probably one of the biggest of those. And that appears to be a moving target, I suppose, in relation to what the most recent statements have been from government, from Ministry for the Environment. Within all of that, we note that the scope of Plan Change 1 is both immediate in terms of a current plan change, which would, in the ordinary course under the Resource Management Act, have an anticipated lifespan of 10 years, but that the overall project has a horizon of around 80 years. And we also note that there are further, at least one further plan change, and probably several further plan changes on their way. And we also know, or we can expect, that the Ministry for the Environment, under whichever government it may be, is likely to be working on the various regulations, national environmental standards, and national policy statements over time as well. So there's a whole lot of moving targets that are involved. Again, we'd like everyone to assist us with an understanding when you talk to us about your priority issues and the changes you expect or the changes your client or the people your client represents are having to cope with, to see it in that mix, and in particular to focus on what we can realistically do now, what we can realistically do over the next few years, and what realistically we are doing as part of a longer term process to try to achieve the goals that we have over 80 years. We're a little concerned from what we've read that there are some matters where there may be a little bit of overreach occurring now rather than recognising what may take a bit more time to deal with. Having said that, we're in no doubt that there are critical issues where we have to change the trend of what we see happening in the environment now. So, that's all quite a mixture. As I say, it's really a question of us asking Council in particular just to be aware of that overall temporal framework and assist us with that. We're also conscious that a number of the issues that we're dealing with have been addressed by the court in relation to Plan Change 10 of the Plenty Regional Plan in relation to the Lake Rotorua, in relation to the Southland Regional Plan, and the nine, I think, decisions, four or five of which are quite substantive in relation to water. And the recent report of the court on the water conservation order affecting Waikaurapupu Springs. And we're aware that a number of you have been involved in all of those proceedings. A number of the parties who are present in relation to Plan Change 1 have been involved in those proceedings. We are aware that there are differences affecting the environment, the catchments in all of those areas, but there are also a number of things which, from the experience of those of us who are on this bench, feel we can benefit from the hard work that was done in those cases by the parties and hopefully by the reasoning of the court in relation to those matters. We do appreciate the immense amount of work that has been undertaken by you all to get to this point. We ask you to bear in mind that the members of the court do not have all of the experience that you have, and so we ask you please to be clear about the issues as you address them, and on a fairly pedestrian basis, please be clear about the acronyms or the buzzwords that are in use, and don't assume that we know the same acronyms or buzzwords that you know. More substantially, please assist us when you are making submissions, or those of you who are here who will be giving evidence, giving your evidence, that you be clear with us about the cause and effect arguments that are present here and about the consequences that are of concern to you in relation to those cause and effect arguments. Right, now, it's not often that the court leaps in right at the beginning, having just taken appearances and before even calling on the proponent of the case to address us, to lay out a whole lot of things in front of you. We really are doing that so that you have those things to bear in mind as we go. But of course, it is important that we hear both sides. If there is anyone who wishes to raise anything about anything that I've just said over the last 15 minutes, in particular, if you've got any concern about anything that I've raised in terms of how the case is likely to go, and you feel that we need to nip that in the bud rather than wait for it, then I'm quite happy to hear from anyone now. Does anyone wish to address us on any of those matters? Mr. Ferguson.
Thank you, sir. That's something I'm sure put themselves forward to raise an issue. Just in relation to the point source discharge, I know the direction came out on Friday to file a memorandum in response, and so we'll be filing a joint one with the Waikato River Authority. I think there is a question of overlap, but we think it can be managed, sir, so we'll address that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Ferguson. I mean, I agree with you completely. There are a number of areas of overlap, and as I was trying to be clear, and I will repeat, we recognise that overlap will be present and we must allow for it. We're just trying to make sure, and the particular concern that was raised was that people who are focused on a particular issue not be taken by surprise by something that has occurred when they didn't think that was going to be raised before us. But acknowledge your point.
And it's acknowledged, too. And I think arising out of the joint witness statement, sir, we're having ongoing discussions with our two witnesses, but if it's a matter of turning up to, say, two paragraphs where they're in agreement, then that would seem to be little utility in that, sir.
No, if you find yourself in a position like that, then a joint memorandum may well be the best way to go.
Thank you, sir.
For all concerned, including us, just in being sure that we know what it is that parties have agreed to.
Yes, and I was conscious there, obviously, that as the timetable precedent has us opening and presenting after the point source discharge, and therefore, and even if it's a, we did give some contemplation to a kind of will say on behalf of those two witnesses, if that might be of assistance to people.
Well, do have a think and do have a discussion about what you think may be the best way to go. And it may well be that prior to the 25th of October, you alert us to what you think is the best idea, and hopefully we can just agree on that.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Majuri.
Thank you, sir. Thank you also for the overview. It's very helpful as we proceed with the case. Just working through, in my mind, your reference to global issues and plant-specific issues, and I think I understand that. It's very hard to answer what I'm going to ask you, but at least put it on the table in the sense of, as you've touched on, jurisdictional matters, substantive matters. Might be, and this is rhetorical, so over to you in a sense, might be that in terms of the end points and outcomes, there may be a series of decisions or interim decisions?
We don't want to presume anything, but in our preliminary discussions, the possibility of interim decisions as occurred in Southland in a number of aspects may well be likely. Again, we'd like for our decision making, particularly if there are interim decisions, to be helpful to the parties. And so if there are aspects where people feel that guidance along the way would be useful, then please don't hesitate to raise them. Thank you.
Your Honour, I just thought I should flag it at this point, because you have raised the scope jurisdictional issue, that both Auckland Waikato Fish and Game Council and Forest and Bird are still opposing the scope to put the Fonterra and nitrogen scorecard into the plan. So submissions will be made on that in due course. Thank you.
I don't know whether you've had any discussions with your friends about that. But we do appreciate that those are aspects which there are differing views on. I suppose, well, I think that's a bridge we should cross when we come to it, perhaps, rather than presuming anything. One of the things would be whether or not your clients see alternatives that might nonetheless provide us with a way forward as we go, rather than simply having an argument about whether it's within jurisdiction or outside jurisdiction.
Yes, thank you for that indication.
Thank you.
All right. Well, let's turn to the hearing proper.
Excuse me, sir. Can I just raise one issue?
Yes.
Just housekeeping issue.
Yes.
If I may. Well, two very brief housekeeping issues. I signalled to you that Beef and Lamb and Federated Farmers were running a joint case.
Yes.
Mr. Matheson will be senior for that.
Right.
Our intention is for one set of legal submissions, one set of cross-examination, etc.
Right.
To assist perhaps with some of the efficiencies for the hearing. So I thought I'd just get that on the record so everyone was clear of our intention. The second issue, sir, and thank you for your indication that people may come and go, I find myself in a slightly unique position and I wonder, sir, if I may have leave to appear remotely from tomorrow if it please your honour for this week.
Well, there's no basic problem with people seeking to appear remotely. There may be technical problems. So leave is granted, but again, it's a little bit like the leave to come and go. It'll be your lookout to make sure that the technology actually gives you the access that you need.
Thank you.
We are working on that, and we will endeavour to make sure that things do work out so that people can participate in that way. I'm slightly surprised. This room has been set up for remote participation. Of course, it's been used for the Fikari White Island health and safety prosecutions recently. And I'm not pointing the finger at anyone, but they changed a few things. And we said, please put it back the way you found it. And I'm not sure that necessarily happened. But anyway, we've got technical people, and we've got a sort of jerry-rigged witness box there, just this desk at the front alongside Mr. Conway, which is to be our witness box unless and until we can get the microphones in the witness box working. So we're trying to make sure that we can keep going, but as I say, it's sometimes the technology gets in the way.
Well,
thank you for that.
It's loud and clear. Thank you, Norman.
Mr. Matheson.
Thank you, sir.
You're not going to disagree.
No. Although I do find myself with three juniors, which is a terrible position to be in, so I have no excuse. So I wish to raise two things, sir. One is the possibility of a site visit for the members of the court at some point over the hearing.
It's a very large site.
It is a very large site. And on that note, I have taken the liberty of sending an email around. I do have some locations and other parties who haven't already provided some suggestions for a magical tour of PC1 catchment. We intend to file that sort of midweek to give the court plenty of time to think about where they might want to go and obviously wherever else. The second point is on the NRS scorecard and the overseer issue, and it's one that has been exercising both our clients in terms of the jurisdiction point.
Mm-hmm.
The proposed solution, which I wanted to flag to the court and the parties now in advance of us presenting our case, is that we would propose to put leave overseer in, mm-hmm, and have the NRS scorecard as an alternative method. That deals with the jurisdiction issue, because of my submission there isn't any jurisdiction issue for an alternative to be added. The issue is the removal of overseer altogether. And that does leave a slightly awkward position where one would have two alternative drafting gates, but it does deal with, in the nature of this plan change, from my client's perspective, they would not right to have to go through a 293 process unnecessarily. So I just wanted to put that on the table in case that assists people. Thank you.
Well, if I can assist in this regard, and as I say, I don't want to cut across any discussions that people are having. I also don't want to determine anyone's rights or interests without there being a proper argument. Nothing that you say, Mr. Matheson, surprises us. These are things that we have ourselves been thinking about as ways in which we can move forward, because our primary concern is to move forward, as Commissioner Hodges and I have said on numerous occasions before in these proceedings. So thank you for indicating that. There may be devil in the detail, and I know that you understand that. I know Ms. Omley understands that. But it does appear to us that the most recent statements from the government have indicated that although Overseer has its problems, it's not necessarily to be taken away as part of the toolkit. The question will be how it is used in that regard and how anything else may be used with it. So thank you. Thank you for that indication. I think we're pleased to know that, as I raised previously, people are thinking of options and alternatives. And we'll just see what that looks like in due course. I don't think we had previously thought about a site visit. It's really a site visits or a tour. We'll be interested to see what people say. Probably going to the headwaters of all the various rivers in the catchment is not necessarily what we may do, but I am aware, for example, in relation to the Watercare Board of Inquiry, that there are a number of very interesting things that can be seen up and down the main stems of the rivers. And so if that's what you're thinking about.
The one site location, there will be a lot of focus in the evidence, both from the Director General, Fish and Game, and my clients, on some of the headwaters in the dry stock farms in the Upper King Country. And Mr. Vieri gave his evidence. His farm is on the border of the very top. It's literally at one of the very top reaches of one of the Waipa main tributaries. And to the extent the court needs to understand and wishes to go on site to understand some of the practical issues, which will be a strong focus of our case, then that will be one of the suggested sites. And the Director General suggested some wetland sites. Anyway, I'll put that on a map.
Yeah, no, if you could give us a list of likely sites and maybe a map with at least some red dots on it to show what the itinerary might involve. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Any more? Going on?
All right. Well, thank you all for that. Mr. Conway.
Thank you, Your Honour. Now, in terms of orientation, I thought it might be useful just to make sure we've got same documents in front of us, and to that end there are two more to hand out that have both been filed with the court electronically in the last few days.
Yes.
One of them is a series of maps relating to the areas.
Can I just ask in relation to that, I began looking at that this morning and my computer, which I didn't think was steam-powered, has been struggling a little. Could you get your technical people to break that 670 megabyte image file, PDF file, down maybe into 10-page segments or something?
Yes.
So that we can manipulate that on our own computers.
Yes, thanks, Ron. I think
I'm surprised that it's struggling at 670 meg, but it is.
It wouldn't be the only device that's been struggling on that, sir. And I wonder if we might also try to simply compress that document. And
well, that's what I, that's where I started, and I've restarted my computer a couple of times now. So I suggest you break it into chunks and then maybe see if you can optimise it. But I wouldn't try optimising the whole file. just based on my experience. But this looks, it may well be that if you can't do that, then this looks as though that's comprehensive. Others, of course, may still want to have it on screen for their purposes.
Yes, thank you, Your Honour. And we can continue working with Council in terms of that as well. The other document is a list of corrections, which is, we're jumping here a little bit, but we thought before our witnesses give you evidence, it might be useful. They've got to be aware of the corrections they're intending to make. So we've got those there.
I've got that. Thank you.
And I'll speak to the relevant ones.
I'm very impressed, but it's a fairly short list.
I was pleased to see. And I can see the colourful bound volumes behind you all indicating what the bundles that we've produced to will be operating, I guess from my perspective, largely electronically. But if at any point you're wishing to get clarification about which volume you should look in, please do signal that and we'll endeavour to make sure you're clear about which document it is. The number series along the top may well be a helpful way to guide that, because in the electronic version, obviously, it's all driven off the index, and then the file names themselves are numbers, which, if you're anything like me, start to lose their meaning, and it's helpful to know that you're in the right one.
Very good.
Now, Your Honour, we have filed a week ago our legal submissions, and it was remiss of me not to ensure we had hard copies for today.
Well, I think we've got our hard copies in relation to that. I mean, we've printed them off.
Yes.
Yes.
So if there's any issue with what you've got there, we can arrange for others. But I thought I'd check that at the outset, because I realised this morning the registrar checked with me that we hadn't actually brought some hard copies along. But what I propose to do is, really, I'm in your hands as to how much of these legal submissions I go through. There was an earlier direction, I think, stemming from the time when we were thinking we would have all legal submissions at the outset of the hearing, and they would all be filed in advance, that all legal submissions would be taken as read, and I think that's the standing direction. But I'm also conscious there's a degree of orientation that might be useful today, and so I don't want to leave you short if there's more information that would be helpful. And so I have a short version option, but I'm also quite happy to take you through the legal submissions more fulsomely.
Well, I think there are a number of if you like, boilerplate type issues that we don't need you to traverse. I doubt that anyone's in under any misapprehension about where we're starting. I do think that the key thing that would assist us, whether this is the base document or whether you do it more generally, would be where the Regional Council sees the primary issues and what the Regional Council considers are the main questions for the court to determine arising out of those issues. I think your submissions have give us a very clear overview of your case, but it's really a question of how the council sees the contest, as it were, or the contests with the various parties or the different groups of parties. That would give us a lot of assistance.
Thank you, Your Honour. In that case, I think it is probably helpful if I do get to the key issues section of the submissions before I conclude. So I think that does sound helpful. What I might do then is I'll start with some introductory comments.
Yes.
I'll start at the outset. I am intending to take you to Tūturi Whaimana.
Yes.
And so that's something that members of the court have at their fingertips that would be helpful. And also the provisions themselves, which were the latest version from the council's perspective at least, is what I'll refer to as the post-conferencing version that was attached to the legal submissions we filed last week. And then I'll step you through some brief numbers on that and then see where that gets us. But if at any point you want to signal to speed up or slow down, I'm quite grateful to hear that.
Thank you.
So
May it please the court, I will start on page one of the submissions and then reasonably quickly step to 35 minutes. 1.2, I note the plan change one is proposed as a new chapter 3.11 of the Waikato Regional Plan. It applies specifically to the Waikato and Waipa River catchments as shown on map 311.1. And if you have the provisions in front of you there, it's probably helpful to look at that. This map has been produced in a range of forms, but it's on page 8 of the provisions, and it looks like so.
Yes.
So you'll see there that the Waikato River is the main blue line running through from Lake Taupō at the bottom of the map right through to the outlet at Port Waikato, and then joining that partway along is the Waipa River. This is the area that Turu Whaimana relates to. It's the area that has been identified as the core area for preparation of this plan change, and it's our focus for this hearing. Back to 1.2, PC1 seeks to restore and protect the health and well-being of water bodies in the Waikato and Waipa River catchments over time, and it does this by regulating the discharge of four major contaminants in the catchment: nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment, and microbial pathogens. And so at that point, it's probably helpful to conceptualise that this is a very much a focused plan change. Rather than trying to bite off every single contaminant that can arise, it's focused on those four for the reasons that we'll come to.
And as we understand it, amongst the various party groups, different contaminants are a focus for different types of land use activity. So nitrogen is not a common issue for all parties. And microbial pathogens might also not be a common problem for all parties. Is that right?
That's right, sir. And I guess there are different priorities in terms of the different parties accordingly.
But from the council's point of view, having reduced its focus, as it were, or brought its focus into the fore, is there a prioritisation at this high level?
At this stage, no. There was originally a prioritisation in some sub-catchments of particular contaminants of concern, but that prioritisation has been removed partly because there wasn't agreement on whether the right ones were being prioritised. I guess that probably indicates in the different locations which were the priority contaminants from the council's perspective, from a water quality angle. But at this point, the intention is to look at all of those four contaminants.
In Southland, one aspect which that council focuses on, not a contaminant, but as a measure in terms of the well-being of the four catchments, four rivers in that region, is the macroinvertebrate community index. And that, if you like, not being a contaminant, but that's an indicator of the health, I suppose, of the ecosystems that are there. I expect that the Waikato Regional Council also has measures of the health of these water systems, but that's not part of the framework for PC1.
There are implementation methods in terms of matters that the council will be continuing to monitor and gather.
Yes.
Some of that monitoring is particularly in relation to what's required by Te Turu Whaimana and to enable the implementation of this plan change. There is also a wider program that's being used to inform the freshwater policy review. Now that's the freshwater policy instrument or plan instrument that will be notified by the end of next year, and you'll hear more about that. Dr. Scarsbrook would probably be well placed to talk about the particular aspects of the monitoring that's going on. So turning now to 1.3, a key driver for the preparation of PC1 was the advent of Te Ture Whai Mana, or Te Awa o Waikato, also known as the vision and strategy for the Waikato River. That is the primary direction-setting document for the Waikato and Waipa rivers. And given its importance, I intend to go there now and talk to, we'll step through the key elements of it, because it really has been a key part of the genesis of this plan change. So if you can bring that up, it's in the 500 series of your documents.
Schedule 2 of the Waikato Tainui Rautatu Claims Act, isn't it?
Yes, it is there too.
Thank you. But hang on.
There's a nice coloured version with some photos of the river as well, if you wish to go to the other version.
So what's the file number for that in the 500?
Is it document 501.0060? Is that what it is?
That's right, you're right.
What's the tab number in the hard copy book?
Tab number 4, Commissioner. Coloured picture on the front if you've got them on. Great, thank you, Your Honour. So the parts I want to step through are really the key parts. Others will speak to components, I'm sure, that have particular meaning as well in terms of their cases. But if we move through to page 4 of that document, bundle page 0063, you'll see there the vision and strategy responds to 4 fundamental issues as set out below. And as we read through those, I just draw attention to the strong nexus between those issues and the regional council's responsibilities when it comes to these catchments. So the first issue is the degradation of the Waikato River and its catchment has severely compromised Waikato River iwi in their ability to exercise mana whakahaere or conduct their tikanga and kawa. And then over time, human activities along the Waikato River and land uses through its catchments have degraded the Waikato River and reduced the relationships and aspirations of communities with the Waikato River. The natural processes of the Waikato River have been altered over time by physical intervention, land use, and subsurface hydrological changes. The cumulative effects of these uses have degraded the Waikato River. And the fourth is that it will take commitment and time to restore and protect the health and well-being of the Waikato River. And in terms of that timing component, there is no specific 80-year time frame set out in Te Ture Whai Mana. That's a time frame that the collaborative stakeholder group came up with as it went through this process to identify how long do we need in order to really realise this vision. Stepping over 2 pages to the vision itself, the vision there is for a future where a healthy Waikato River sustains abundant life and prosperous communities who in turn are all responsible for restoring and protecting the health and well-being of the Waikato River and all it embraces for generations to come. And then we step forward to the objectives themselves, two pages on. And I just want to draw your attention to a subset of those. There are 13 of them. The first is the core headline, which is the restoration and protection of the health and well-being of the Waikato River. Stepping down to G, the recognition and avoidance of at least cumulative effects and potential cumulative effects of activities undertaken both on the Waikato River and within its catchments on the health and well-being of the Waikato River. H is the recognition that the Waikato River is degraded and should not be required to absorb further degradation as a result of human activities. I is the protection and enhancement of significant sites, fisheries, flora and fauna. And K is the restoration of water quality within the Waikato River so that it's safe for people to swim in and take food from over its entire length. Now, there are people who do swim in it in the lower reaches. I've seen that myself, and I guess the point is we want to make sure that they're safe to do so rather than taking a risk at that point.
And then one of the keys for me, Mr. Conway, is ensuring not only that you can swim, but that you can take food from it.
Yes, that's right.
So from my perspective, that has to be a focus, but also given your initial submission about timing, I'm interested as to what time frame you say that particular aspiration should be achievable.
It's a very good question, Your Honour. I don't have a specific answer or time frame of when we will be at that point. The 80-year time frame that this has been built around is, in some ways it feels like a long time, and there may well be some significant improvement well before then that means the safety is increasing as we go along. There may not be a particular point at which you say it's expressly switched over from being unsafe to safe, but particularly in light of the types of contaminants and the fact that the water may not be homogenous as to the particular qualities at each point. Will be an increasing trend of safety at increasing locations along it, perhaps is how I would express it. I'm quite conscious that probably doesn't answer your question.
No. Okay, thank you.
On page 10 of the Tūrewhaimana, you'll see there that there is a map of the catchments, and that really just confirms that's the same area of interest as the area to which Plan Change 1 relates. You see both of the awa there, and you see the overall boundaries aligned.
Are there any strategies that you want to emphasise to go with the objectives?
Your Honour, the strategy, actually it's a good point. The strategies there are there on page 7.
Yeah.
I wasn't particularly planning on taking you through individual ones, but as you'll see there, there are 12 particular strategies that are endeavouring to provide ways in which this will be achieved. And the first one there really is ensuring the highest level of recognition is given to the restoration and protection of the Waikato River, which underpins this particular plan change.
I think as you come to later in your submissions, that the legislation makes clear that this is a national policy statement, and indeed my recollection is that it has priority in a similar way to the way the New Zealand Coastal Policy Statement can also have priority among national policy statements.
Yes, that's right, Your Honour. To the extent there's any conflict between this and any national policy statement, the Tūrewhaimana prevails. So it's slightly unusual in that it's part of the regional policy statement,
yes,
but it has...
It's at a higher level.
That's right. That's right. So returning now to my submissions, at 1.4 I talk about the background to the preparation of Plan Change 1, and I've set that out in... further on in these submissions at part 5, I think it is. But I wanted to talk through this in a slightly different way now to tell that story, because the story of the development is quite important in terms of the community input and involvement. The relevant treaty settlements and iwi relationships have been central to the genesis of Plan Change 1 and to its development. The Council shares co-governance and co-management responsibilities 85 Waikato and Waipa River iwi under the settlement legislation, and the development of Plan Change 1 in partnership with the River Iwi has reflected that. And the Council also recognises that there is a lot at stake with this process. In addition to the relationships of iwi with the awa and the way those have incredible significance, communities and businesses have also built up in the catchment, and the Waikato Waipa catchment represents a significant component of the country's primary production economy. So one of the first things the Council recognised is that it was always going to be difficult to come up with a plan change and some plan provisions that would meet everyone's needs or aspirations at the same time. And this is why the Council wanted those who would be most impacted to hold the pen on this plan change. There was a time period between 2017 and 2020 when the RMA expressly had a collaborative planning process as part of it, and I think it got whipped out when people realised it was probably just too hard, and perhaps this bespoke collaborative process that was used for this plan change might be an indication of just how hard that can be to carry out a plan change that is truly collaborative. The process that was used for the development of PC1 predated, or the start of it predated, that process that was entered into the RMA, so it didn't use that collaborative planning process. Instead, the Council set up a particular process that's outlined in Ms. May's evidence, and you'll hear from her on Monday next week. And that was used to prepare it, and then from there on it followed the normal RMA Schedule 1 process once it was notified. A key element of that process was the collaborative stakeholder group. So that was a group of, as the name suggests, stakeholders from around the region, from different industries and sectors, and the community and Māori interests, who came together to work out what the plan should be. That is the group that held the pen on this plan change. The sectors nominated who they wanted to be on the Collaborative Stakeholder Group, or CSG, and Council and iwi staff co-selected those who expressed interests for community and Māori representatives. A huge amount of time and effort was invested by the members of that group and the other technical specialists, the committee and community members. And so at the outset of this hearing, the Council wanted me to express its gratitude for all of the efforts that those people put in to develop this plan change, and to acknowledge and thank them today, including those who have been involved in the hearing and appeal processes. The result was a plan change that was drafted by the community and not by the Council. The proposed plan change was supported for notification by the Co-Governance Committee by way of a formal committee recommendation to Council, and the Council has sought to maintain the integrity of the direction set by the Collaborative Stakeholder Group and then by the Independent Hearing Panel through the further amendments that have been made in the appeal process. So the way it worked was the CSG wrote the text that was in the proposed plan change. The Council adopted that in full, put it out to the public for submissions for an extended submission period of 80 working days, and then an independent hearing panel heard submissions, and then the Council adopted all of the recommendations of that IHA. And a lot of what's left to resolve at this point relates really to the way in which the plan change is to achieve the key goals. When we come to the objectives and policies, you'll see the objectives in particular, the first two, which set the direction for this plan change, substantially agreed between the parties. And so in summary, it's most people are in agreement about what the plan change is trying to achieve. It's the how it really does bring the particular differences into focus. And so there are parties seeking that it becomes stricter in order to achieve those goals over a shorter time frame. And there are parties who are saying that it's putting too much pressure on our land uses and we can't do that. It would be good to have some more flexibility. And so the council has endeavoured to balance those matters while maintaining the integrity of the original court direction.
Are you saying that the primary area of disagreement or even conflict would be around timing? Or is it more than that?
It's more than that, sir. I guess timing is the ultimate outcome of the way in which the particular policies and methods and particular rules would have their impact. So should they be stricter and therefore require more improvement in this first 10-year period? Or should they be relaxed slightly? And is it possible to have both? Both more improvement but also flexibility to enable users to genuinely achieve this, being aware of the pressure that users are under too.
And I assume you'll address us on this later, Mr. Conroy, but of course there's a proposed change of use issue which has been raised by Tanaka Whenua.
Yes, that's right, sir. And I guess that is, to touch on that now, in terms of Te Ture Whai Mana and the Puke Coal case, which made it clear that Te Ture Whai Mana is intended to represent a step change in the management and consenting of land use, it also identified that there was a degree of betterment that would be required for an intensification of land use. And so the baseline here is not to keep the level of those four contaminants the same as where they're at now, it's to reduce them. And for parties who are endeavouring to, individuals or entities that are wanting to increase the intensity of their use, there needs to be some quid pro quo from them to provide betterment so that we're not just maintaining current levels. And so when we get to the challenge of Tangata Whenua ancestral land, which is is I guess awaiting or there's aspirations for further development of that. The challenge becomes evident here that there is a need to work out how that can be done while still maintaining and restoring overall. And so yes, we will come to that. Now, the rest of part one of my submissions really is step through the procedure and how we've got to where we are now. The appeals are complex, as I note in 1.6. There have been 22 days of court-assisted mediations, as I've noted in 1.7. The topic divisions weren't carried through because we realised through mediations there's so much overlap and interaction between them. And while in 1.8 I note there were no consent orders resulting from the mediation process, the significant number of changes that have been made to the provisions reflect the hard work that everyone did through that process. We've got joint witness statements also that are in front of the court in the 400 series, I think it is, of the bundle, and obviously you would have seen those. Now, in terms of the overview of Plan Change 1, I thought it might be helpful to step through part 4 of these submissions with the provisions in front of you. And so if you have got the provisions there, and I'll step through with these sort of side by side. I don't want to take you through every single provision, but it's more just orientating the court to what's there and how it's worked. So if you've got that document in front of you, that was the one that was attached to our legal submissions.
Is that the same as what's at 101.0121? The decisions version?
No, you're right. This is the post-conferencing version. So There was a version.
Yes, I know.
Yes. It was within the same PDF as our legal submissions when they were filed. Started on page 53 of that PDF. Okay. It's probably worth checking that you do have that. That we filed a version on Monday last week that had that attached. There was also a hyperlinked version of our legal submissions that we filed at the end of last week that did not have this attached to it. So if you were looking at that version, you may not have this document. Now would be. It's good to check that. I think we've all got it at this point.
Yeah, no, I've got your legal submissions with them attached.
And so the document after the appendix labels is a cover page that indicates the different colour coding that's in that document. So that shows throughout this what the particular changes that have been made. So the evidence in chief version that Mr. Trebilco attached, that incorporated all of the changes that identified through mediation and consideration of the party's appeals. Then there were some supplementary evidence changes once the freshwater farm plan regulations came through and the also the Fonterra and nitrogen risk scorecard clarifications were made. They're in purple, and then the blue ones are the rebuttal evidence changes, and then green are some further changes after expert conferencing. We're conscious that it's difficult when there's a proliferation of versions, it can be difficult to read the post-tracking versions, but I'm hoping that the nature of the tracking that's in this document doesn't create too many challenges, because it's, in a lot of cases it's more about what's being added rather than having huge amounts to strike through.
Just so I'm clear what I'm looking at, it's the appendix which is attached to your submission that you're currently referring to, right?
Yes, that's right, you're right. And I'm been referring to this as the post-conferencing version. I guess that's useful by way of terminology. So stepping through this document, there are preliminaries in there. There is the map that I referred you to earlier, which with the freshwater management units. You'll see there that there are 8 freshwater management units. There are 4 river FMUs, the Upper Waikato River, the Waipa River, the Middle Waikato River, and the Lower Waikato River. So those are the big 4, the 4 big blue pictures. And then there are also 4 different lake FMUs, which are in different colours showing on the legend there. They're much smaller. The June ones in particular, it's very difficult to see at A4 level, but they're right down by Port Waikato. Stepping through the background and explanation. The objectives are the first place I really want to land in this document. As I've said in 4.2, PC1 includes a framework of objectives, policies and methods and rules intended to improve water quality over time by addressing the 4 major contaminants. The key directives in PC1 are objectives 1 and 2. That's what I'm at 4.3 of my legal submissions. Objective 1 provides longer-term direction for restoring and protecting water bodies in the catchments. And in particular, it requires that water bodies are safe for people to swim in and take food from at the latest by 2096. And that's the long-term goal. The Objective 2 provision provides a shorter term direction of progress to be achieved over the life of the plan. It requires that interim target attribute states are met no later than 10 years after the plan change becomes operative. And then the 10 and 80 year attribute states are set out in Table 311. one along the flatline studies. And there's a lot of detail on those tables, and I don't intend you to take you to those, but I'm sure when Dr. Scarsbrook gives evidence, you'll hear about those. The interim 10-year target attribute stakes are set at 20% of the 80-year target attribute stakes over the 10-year life of the plan. And the reason for that is because there was recognition that by the time we get through the process, the start date of 2016 doesn't really reflect when the 10-year start date would be, so it was important to bite off more than, say, 10% of that overall goal, and so 20% was set. And as far as I'm aware, there is agreement of that in relation to that goal. Objective 3, which the joint witness statement indicates is agreed, I think, seeks that people are assisted to provide for their social, economic, spiritual and cultural well-being. Objective 4 seeks that tangata whenua values are integrated into the management of water bodies. And Objective 5 specifically recognises the whangamarino wetland as an outstanding water body and seeks restoration and protection of its health and well-being at the latest by 2096. The most common sources of diffuse discharges are farming activities, and to achieve the objectives, particularly Objectives 1 and 2, PC1 implements a policy and rule framework to regulate the use of land for farming, including any associated diffuse discharge of the four contaminants to water or onto land in circumstances which may result in those contaminants entering water. The definition of farming captures pastoral farming, dry stock and dairy, commercial vegetable production and arable cropping. So you'll hear about CVP, that's commercial vegetable production. PC1 also includes four policies relating to point source discharge, but the rules for point source discharges are included elsewhere in the regional plan. So these are policies to particularly supplement the way those other rules will be applied, rather than resulting in changes in the rules here. I don't propose you to take you through the policies in detail. You'll see, though, if you step through that document, there are a significant number of changes that have been made to these policies through the process. A large proportion of those have been made through what the council team learned and was assisted by through mediation, and I guess that is another point to note, the council's gratitude for the investment that parties put into that process. Further changes have been made subsequently, and you'll see if you step through those, and there are some that there is only a small amount of traffic, and then there are some that's more significant.
Mr. Conway, just in terms of objective number 4, there's two issues I wanted to canvas with you, and I don't know if now is the right time to do it or later on. We may or may not propose to deal with the definition of tangata whenua and ancestral lands, for example. But as I understand it from the evidence of Mr. Trevelco and certainly from the documents I've seen, the definition of tangata whenua and ancestral lands, there's disagreement about what that definition should include. For example, I don't think Mr. Trevelco agrees that a definition of general land under the jurisdiction of the Te Tiriti Māori Act should be included. And I wonder if you had a view on that.
Sir, I don't have anything particularly to add to what he's raised at this point. That is a matter that will no doubt exercise the court's mind. I'd probably point to and rely on his evidence in that respect to this point.
You might want to give that some consideration, Mr. Conway, because there is a legal definition of what general land is within the jurisdiction of the Māori Land Court or under the Te Tiriti Māori Act, and I'm not sure Mr. Trevelco has addressed that. So from a legal perspective, you might want to have a look at that.
Thank you, Your Honour. It might be that's something I can come back to you on.
That's the first thing. The second thing is in relation to references to mana or mana whakahau, because those two terms are not the same. So I'm wanting to understand from you what is meant when those terms are employed in this particular objective. So
we may not be able to help you with it today, and it's fine, but at some stage it'd be, I'd find it helpful if you could.
Thank you, that's a really helpful signal.
Just on the policies, you said that there wasn't a great deal at issue in relation to the objectives. Is there much at issue now in the policies?
Less than there was before mediation, but still some difference. I think there has been a thoroughgoing and genuine attempt to capture the points that were concerned without making these too long, and they might already be there, but grasping the issues that people have raised. And perhaps we'll come back to that when we can.
Well, I'm sure that we will.
Turning over past the policies, you'll see that there are implementation methods, and these are matters that relate to things like monitoring, as well as providing information for farm environment plans. So these are steps that the council will undertake in order to ensure that alongside the implementation of the rules, there is the right information to guide all parties. So that's broadly the intent of those implementation methods. Then the rules, there are 10 rules, starting on page 26 of that appendix of mine. And in stepping through those briefly, you'll see there that there is a permitted activity rule 311.4.1 for small and very low intensity farming. And then an interim permitted activity rule, which I want to highlight because that's the rule that means that until these provisions become operative, the rules generally don't start to bite and have effect. And the reason for that rule is that essentially, because there's a staged approach to requiring consents in different catchments to avoid one large onrush of 5,000 odd consent applications in 1 year, there needs to be a rule that will enable people who haven't yet had their application date arise to continue to operate. Then, as we step through the rules, you'll see there's a gradual increase in intensity of farming that's dealt with. So rule 311.4.3 is for low intensity farming, that's still a permitted activity. And then we move up to moderate intensity farming as a controlled activity rule, 311.4.4. And then commercial vegetable production is dealt with by way of two main rules. The first is 311.4.5, which is a controlled activity rule. So that's for existing commercial vegetable production. And then there is a separate rule over a couple of pages, 311.4.8, for commercial vegetable production expansion. And that's the discretionary activity rule. And the reason I say two main rules is because going back to 311.4.6, which is a restricted discretionary activity rule for farming in the Whanga Merino wetland catchment, that deals with all types of farming there. So if you're in that catchment and you're CVP, you're dealt with under that rule too. Coming back to page 31 of that document, rule 311.4.7a is a restricted discretionary activity rule for high-risk dairy farming. Now all these risks are essentially the ones that are dealt with under this proposal by using the Fonterra nitrogen risk scorecard in relation to dairy farming and by using stock numbers in relation to other types of pastoral farming. 311.47 is a default catch-all rule for activities not otherwise covered. We've touched on 311.48, which is the commercial vegetable production expansion. And then finally, rule 311.49, a non-compliant activity rule for land use change. And this is the one, Your Honour, Judge Williams, that Federal ancestral land commercial, expansion or land use change would come under as well, and that is a core point of disagreement when we come to that point, because there's a question really there around, well, what's the right level of enabling, and should that be done through objectives and policies, or also should there be a different activity status,
yes.
And how can we best enable that use, that land use change in a way that respects the connection with that land, while also managing the way this fits in terms of the overall goals under 2.9. So that's
one of the concerns, is whether or not they can even make that land change in the first place, isn't it?
Sorry.
I think one of the first concerns is whether or not there is an ability to make a second land change use. That's part of the argument.
Under these rules, that's right. There's a question there around, you know, in the right situations, will the land use activity consent application be able to be granted,
yes.
While retaining the right level of discretion. So yeah, that is one of the core issues in dispute. Generally in relation to the rules, on that 4.6 of my legal submissions, key rule conditions relate to minimum farming standards, which are in Schedule C. Those are standards that are intended to apply to every farming activity. They're intended to be standards that all farms should be able to meet as a baseline, with other requirements coming on over top of that and becoming stricter depending on the increase in intensity of the activity. There is also a requirement there about stock exclusion and farm environment plans and conditions. And as I say in 4.6, an FEP or farm environment plan is not required under Plan Change 1 for small and very low intensity farming, which is a permitted activity under Rule 1. Beyond that, there are two tiers of FEPs. There are low intensity permitted activities, and those require a standards-based farm environment plan that Plan Change 1 does not require to be certified. So it's intended to be in reasonably predictable situations. There are standards that get applied to that, and essentially the monitoring of that gets done first at the stage of preparing that, and so the council doesn't have as much of much involvement in the actual preparation of those FDPs.
So that could occur within a farm that had a more comprehensive FDP required. There could be parts of.
This is a good question that might be helpful to traverse when Mr. Bilko's there, because I call Mr. Brocksop potentially, because off the top of my head I wouldn't want to guess an answer at that, but where an activity as a whole requires a farm environment plan, certainly when it requires one under the regulations, which I'll touch on briefly, that whole farm environment plan is likely to be dealt with as one plan. So there may be small areas where you say, well, it depends how you divide the farm and the activity and whether that's dealt with as one unit or as multiple small units. So the higher intensity consented activities, including the CVP, require a certified farm environment plan, which is more discretionary and it's based on goals and principles rather than standards. Now, at this point, I just want to mention briefly, in terms of certification, there has been a change to what's required through the Freshwater Farm Plan regulations, and we'll touch on them in a bit more detail later. But this is one of the integration things that Mr. Drabilko had to do once those freshwater farmland regulations came out to ensure that plan change one didn't require one type of farm environment plan, freshwater farmlands didn't require another type, and you somehow had to prepare two, and they were subject to different requirements for certification at different times and to different standards. So what Mr. Trebilco has endeavoured to do is to piggyback the requirements for PC1 farm plans on the top of the freshwater farm plan regulations. So there may be farms where only PC1 requires a farm plan, in which case it would be dealt with under these provisions. But in most cases, because of the overlap between the requirements, it's likely that parties who need a farm plan will also need a freshwater farm plan, in which case the requirements of Plan Change 1 are additive on top of what the regulations require. The low-intensity permitted activity ones in PC1 are not required to be certified under PC1, but it's quite possible that a lot of those, if they meet the area thresholds under the regulations, in other words, for example, a pastoral farm with more than 20 hectares will require a farm plan under the freshwater farm plan regulations, and that will need to be certified. So in that case, essentially, even though PC1 doesn't require it, you'll be caught by the regs. There's a bit of complexity in there, and Mr. Smith's evidence traverses that in a bit more detail, but it's probably worth just noting there for now that there's that interplay, and there's been an attempt to ensure that the provisions work well together.
Bureaucracy is an issue, isn't it? Because of the different levels of control and the risk of various ways of doing things, potentially ultimately for the same purpose, but requiring operators to do things more than once in order to comply.
Yes. There's going to be enough to do under this that for everyone's sake it's important not to double up.
Yeah, and that... Yes. And I mean, it's been a long time since the Minister participated in hearings of this kind, but it's potentially an issue because, I mean, you may be able to tell me to what extent the Ministry keeps up with what different councils are doing in this regard and tries to integrate its regulatory proposals with those being pursued by the council.
Not sure I would want to comment on that, sir. I'm not aware of it specifically that I suspect there's an attempt, but it's challenging to keep up on both
Indeed.
Sides.
Yeah.
In 4.7, I note there that there has been modelling that's been undertaken. Dr. Oliver Alvasola and Mr. Keenan for the council. They've attempted to simulate the decisions version of PC1 and assess whether the interim target attribute states would be met. Mr. Keenan summarised his view that suggests that around one quarter of the targets would not be met. Specifically, there were more breaches of nitrogen state attributes, mostly in the upper Waikato and Waikato FMUs, as of freshwater management units. However, overall, the modelling suggests that the decisions version of PC1 has the potential to make significant improvements in the catchment, although not necessarily the 20% improvements set as interim 10-year targets at all sites. In 4.8, I've noted there the point I touched on as we went through the rules, the effect of this interim permitted activity rule. And so I don't think I necessarily need to step through that in detail, but the core conclusion of that is... part of the reason for the council's motivation to get this plan change operative is to enable those dates to start running from which consent applications need to be made. 4.9 is explained by Mr. McAuliffe and Mr. Trebilco, several government initiatives that have overtaken PC1. The two with the greatest immediate consequences for PC1 are the government review of Overseer and the freshwater farm plan regulations, which came into force on the 1st of August. The government review of Overseer is important because the decisions version of PC1 specifies rural gateways using an Overseer-derived nitrogen leaching loss rate. The council has interpreted the government review as meaning that Overseer is not fit for the purpose it's intended to fulfil under PC1. And the freshwater farm plan regulations are important because misalignment between the requirements for FEPs under Plan Change 1 and freshwater farm plans under the regulations, as we've said, creates a risk of duplication and uncertainty. Now, in part 9 of these submissions, I go back to address Overseer a bit more,
yeah.
And then part 25, I deal with section 293.
Yeah.
And I'm conscious that's a matter that you've raised today. And I've been able to
well, it does seem to us, I mean, it has seemed in terms of what we've been doing on the way since these appeals were lodged, is to try to keep an eye on what tools are available. And as was raised on a very preliminary basis by Mr. Matheson, is keeping an eye out for this. I note what you're saying here. We shouldn't embark on a discussion about the fit-for-purpose issue in detail at this stage, but it is something that I think is of great concern to us. Whether or not that means that Overseer is not useful for anything. I mean, it may not be, it was never designed for the purpose to which it's been put in this plan change, but whether it is useful as a tool to help us move forward, I think is a different question.
Yes, understood, sir. And I think the core way I'd conceptualise it in terms of what Mr. Matheson fairly raised is the use of two separate methodologies to get you through to rural gateways will be really challenging. And that's why the council has preferred an approach that would see Overseer replaced rather than supplemented. I understand the concern, but the reasoning in my respectful submission for using Overseer as an adjunct, so it sits alongside the methods that are in this version of the plan change, this would be to avoid the delay and uncertainty created by Section 293. So we could avoid that process hassle by keeping it in there. But what we'd be doing in my submission would be creating a planning framework that is not most appropriate, because it would create more uncertainty on an ongoing basis than we'd be solving by resolving the process question now. And so that's why the council, in summary, prefers the approach of removing Overseer, albeit that no submitter sought that, no appellant sought that, so it would require a Section 293 process.
Yes, well, there, yes. We'll take a break now. I see that clock, a bit like me, it's still winter time.